Hello and welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harpsong for a Radical, the life and times of Eugene Victor Debs. We're on chapter 24, page 76. And the other thing that I thought of the other day was that I can understand why she was watching. In the introduction, it talked about her watching the civil rights movement and marches and things going on at that time, and saying they really need to know about this history of the U.S. And now I understand why. And I'm sure there's a very good reason why none of this is in the history of the U.S. considering how much they're freaking out about stuff now. All right. Sailing against the tide from the new world to the old, taking his utopian chance with his Joker's card, Wilhelm Wittling, with his fool's cap pamphlets, had arrived in France and had reached Paris on a Sunday, 2 days before the end of the July Revolution of 1830. Louis-Philippe, the citizen king who under his black umbrella had walked about the impoverished labyrinth of districts, labyrinthine districts of Paris, talking to sewage workers and other poor workers and trying to find out in what ways he could help them, shelter them, he had once told Robert Owen that he wished he could do more, but that the circumference of his protection was limited, had been forced to abandon his throne and under his protective umbrella traveling in disguise, as plain William Smith had fled from France to England for sanctuary. Robert Owen had written, as red Republicans and Bonapartists rioted in the streets, tossing building blocks and hearse wagons and steeples and steeplejacks at each other, while crying out the same magical watchwords, liberty, fraternity, and equality, one of his many letters to the world. His dialogue entre la France, le monde et Robert Owen, dialogue between France, the world, and Robert Owen, which appeared in every Paris newspaper and on every wall, sometimes pockmarked with blood, had been as pacific as doves in a city where there were many bloody doves and few who could bill and coo through the battle, although there must always have been some. According to Robert Owen, who had never admitted the defeat of his utopia on the banks of the Wabash, and who had been elected not only father of the British labor movement, but father of the human race, and who was still placing his faith in his scrolls and maps, which would lead mankind out of its present morass of capitalism onto the unmoving rock of ages, both parties were wrong. I come to your country in this important crisis to the history of all nations to explain that in the spirit of kindness and love for you and the entire family of man in what manner you may render useless all the implements of destruction, give happiness to France, and through its example ensure the permanent progressive happiness of the world. The Archbishop of Paris had been shot through the back, quite by accident, during the raging storm. There were mothers and babies bleeding in gutters. There were bloody babies' hands strewn all over the streets. Men who were flattened under falling paving stones, clowns killed by falling gargoyles. Forces larger than those of war had seemed to work as in every war of the rational against the irrational, and of the irrational against the rational. The earth gave off a sighing, lonely sound. Was happiness after all the instinct of the universe, for was there not universal sorrow? Why had the revolution failed? It would be Wittling's theory, as he looked back, that two-thirds of the leaders in 1830 had represented the old money bags, and that the mistake of the proletariat, or as Marx called it, the lumpen proletariat, had been apparently not to act so much upon original impulse or passion of feeling informing every worker's cell as to emulate the French Revolution to the extent that the revolutionary birth had turned out to be that of a babe who was a bastard. Wilhelm Wittling had been in touch with hundreds, thousands of the suppressed and depressed at this time. His pamphlets... Okay, this is more German. I'm not going to be able to pronounce. Garantien der Harmonie und Freiheit, or Guarantees of Harmony and Freedom, which would be its name in the English translation, were going along with other foolscap publications to revolutionary workmen's cells in France and Germany and Switzerland, and to wherever rails could reach. He was also in touch with various anarchic communal heads, who believed in the flowering of the ego in an altruistic sense, which might be founded according to their ideals of brotherhood and sisterhood. Some who would set off on their own, some who would remain in Europe and Asia Minor and Asia, others who would come into New York Harbor, where there was no harmony, but discord as to what should be the golden way in spite of Wittling's having spread his propaganda to such important points as Poughkeepsie and Cincinnati and St. Louis. To mention only three rival cities, which were crucial in the land of water. Brother Wittling's passage by way of London to New York Harbor had been paid in part with a profit that was raised in part by the American-German disciples of the Cooperative Brotherhood movement by marvelous games of raffles, in which it was easier to raise money for the possibly already lost cause, which was the utopian prospect, than it would have been if there had been no visible prizes or embodiments, such as a workman's lantern or a bag of grain or a pregnant sow or a rooster for the pot or spade or a beehive. The pressures upon Wilhelm Wittling because of his need for money had provided the motive for all he did, according to analysis made of him by Engels in his attempt to understand what had prompted him. On October 29, 1850, a month before death, snatched the little red fox from his father's loving arms. The financial distress that Mark suffered in his exile in London was so altogether intense that he had written to Wittemeyer in Frankfurt that he should please borrow from a local socialist or anybody there the money with which to redeem the family silver in the pawn shop there, then sell the silver to a goldsmith or anybody there, pay the man from whom he had borrowed, and send the remainder to him. These were the silver pieces which his wife, then pregnant with the little red fox, had carried in a bag to the pawn shop at Brussels. The doggedly persistent Marx, the poor man who was trying to show the way to a solution of the world's economic problems, could assure the faithful Wittemeyer that he and the other man would run no risk in this transaction, for if they were unable to sell the thing at a higher price, they would always take it back to the pawn shop. They could always take it back to the pawn shop. The only pieces I ask you to turn to the pawn shop are a small silver goblet, a silver plate, the small fork, and knife in a case. These silver pieces of little sales value belong to his little daughter Jenny. No matter how poor he was, however, he had generously shared whatever bread he had with other exiles in flight from the continent to they knew not always where. A starving exile might be found upon his doorstep almost every morning. Little Jenny, little Laura, and little Eleanor, the three daughters who would survive him, were taught the English language by way of Shakespeare's plays, which were, as Mark said, a family Bible. The bright little Jenny, very asthmatic, knew her Hamlet very well, and the mad Ophelia, scattering flowers on her way to her watery grave, and the speech which the melancholy Dane delivered to the skull of the jester Yorick. Little Jenny was able to judge who was the real socialist exile coming to call on Mark, sometimes to share a heel of bread or a thin suit made of old potato peelings, and who was the poser, the clown, the mont-banc, merely pretending to be a communist. Marx was always to be astonished by the detachment with which most Englishmen wrote of the great monetary question, which was the Sphinx of that time and was to continue to be the Sphinx, but supposed it was because they generally had money, whereas he was so nearly bankrupt that he hardly knew where the next meal was coming from, and it was the cotton broker Engels who, with his generous nature, time and again saved him. So far as other socialist messiahs were concerned, Marx was embittered by their deviations away from the science of dialectic materialism and was repelled by the wild leaders who never tired of wafting public incense around the heads and feet of little great men as if they were worthy of worship. All right. And today's Saturday. So I will be back next week. All right, I think that's it. Again, it made sense to me that I'm sure, and all of this is in hindsight, because of course hindsight is 20/20 when you're looking at history, but it was like these countries like Russia, China, Cuba, they were all the oppression of those people, and even France with all their revolution as well, the oppression of people was something we can't even imagine. As far as the peasants in Russia, I'm sure in China the same condition, and in Cuba. In Cuba, they kind of bragged about how Havana was for the rich and, you know, what the rich were doing in those places. Kind of like what they do now in the Caribbean, where they own, like, there's very few public properties. Everything's really owned up by private entities. I think what was one of the places visited, there's maybe one public beach and the rest of them are privately owned for private tourist destinations and stuff like that. So the poverty there, and it just seems like How blind do you have to be that you don't understand what you're doing to people? And then that's why they revolted. Like, that's why they chose this extreme. fighting against, just fighting to survive, in that case. And so I saw, I think I'm on Threads or something, which is pretty good, because I'm not on X anymore. Twitter changed his name to X and I left before that. I realized this when I went back to college in the early 2000s, is that the history that I grew up under, where you did not look at Marx in any way, shape, or form, you didn't read those things, you didn't talk, you didn't ponder those things. What we had done was right. And there was no question in it. And since the boomers have stayed in power for 50 years in politics and in this country, because they've been able to hold on to power for so long, they don't understand. They don't understand the sentiment around that has changed. The Cold War ended, and the sentiment around that, around socialism and progressivism and I'm not sure communism, but socialism at least, changed to where people were like, oh, hey, yeah, this isn't working. like we've carried this out to its logical extreme and conclusion, and it's not working for us. So, you know, Gen Z now is more populist than any of the other generations. So yeah, we may get some change. I hope so. Excuse me. I don't know why my voice is fine until I come in to read and then it craps out. But yeah, so interesting. All right. Thank you for listening. Hope you're doing well.